This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk. Hello and welcome to Market Talk. In a week of central bank announcements, today's episode will cover the outlook for the US, the UK and Japan, and what interest rate decisions could mean for markets, currencies and investors. My name's Harry Brooks. I'm a content manager in L&G's asset management business, and I'm joined today by Ben Bennett, Head of Investment Strategy Asia, who joins us as normal from Hong Kong. Ben, how are things, Ben?
Pretty good, thanks, Harry. Actually, I just got back from my first ever visit to Japan. I was in Tokyo this weekend just for a little holiday, so it was a lot of fun, but a lot of rules in Japan. I think that's my undying sort of memory from the trip.
Excellent. I hope to go one day. I've not been yet, but one day I'll get there. So before we get into the latest from the central banks, I wanted to start by talking about what feels like a longer term disconnect, perhaps, in the market narrative. Equity markets, as I'm sure our listeners will know, are trading at all-time highs, and the US particularly performance over the last couple of years has been pretty amazing, really, with the S&P up virtually 50% in that time. But despite that incredible run, really, it just hasn't felt, to me at least, like a period of exuberance. Instead, it seems like markets are sort of defying the narrative rather than feeding it here. Is it fair to say that investors have been very worried about things that in many cases just haven't really materialized?
Oh, we're starting off in a very philosophical way today, aren't we? But yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it feels as though we talk about lots of concerns every time we chat, doesn't it? And yet, as you say, the markets go up. I mean, one phrase that people talk about is that, you know, markets, investors are climbing the wall of worry, which is sort of, I guess, there's concerns, and if the concerns don't happen, then markets go up. I think it's more complicated than that. Of course it is. And there's the sort of the best way I guess to describe it is that since COVID, really, there's been two issues that we've worried about, but they've offset each other. One is potential downside risk to growth, the risk, I guess, of a recession. And the other one is the upside risk to inflation, the risk that, you know, prices get out of control and the Federal Reserve has to hike interest rates. And that was the thing that was really taking over markets back just, I guess, just after COVID, 2021, 2022, when the Fed was hiking rates aggressively to try and get inflation under control. That was the last time we had a real serious correction in equity markets. And since then, those two concerns have sort of been in balance. You know, whenever we've been worried a bit about inflation, the inflation's cooled a little bit, and it's cooled enough to allow the central bank to cut interest rates. And then when we've sort of got a concern about growth, again, the central bank has come out and said, and we'll talk about that, I guess, in a minute, that they've been able to come out and cut interest rates again to support us. So it's this sort of middle ground with the central bank able to support markets or to support the economy compared to back, like I said, during COVID when the central bank was almost fighting markets by hiking interest rates. That's probably the best way of thinking about it. But look, we have had issues in this time as well. And we've had a few wobbles. I mean, we've spoken about them in the past, and, you know, stagflation, where there's weakness and inflation creeping up. I don't think that has totally gone away. So let's not just sound that this is the all clear yet. We've still got a few things to worry about. Maybe that means that the market continues to go up as we get over it.
That's a helpful way of framing it, thinking about those two opposing forces. Thinking about the question in a slightly different way, I suppose, what would you say has allowed equity markets to power ahead despite all of this macroeconomic and geopolitical uncertainty that we've seen?
But let's say equity markets are not necessarily 100% reflection of the economy that they are representing, I guess. You know, let's say the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ in the US. These are big companies which have a huge proportion of their earnings related to technology and also to the artificial intelligence, whereas, you know, the average smaller company in the US perhaps doesn't have quite the same artificial intelligence sensitivity. Maybe it's just corner shops or whatever it might be, right? So I think the S&P 500, the equity markets, have really benefited from these secular growth engines, and artificial intelligence being the main one. The spending associated with that, which is come back and supported companies like Nvidia. And then the hope that in the future that will lead to even more profitability. That's really supporting stuff. And earnings have been very strong across these equity markets in general. We just had an earnings season, didn't we? Which is sort of 10% growth year on year in earnings in the US. And that's also the case in places like Europe. You know, the companies in Europe that have benefited from AI and companies in Europe that benefited from other positive trends like defense have been doing very, very well as well. So I think those are the things that have been supporting markets. It's not always the case, though, that equity markets are outperforming the actual economy. Take China, for example, and famously for a few decades now, Chinese growth has been very strong. It's slowing now, but Chinese economic growth does really well. And that hasn't been reflected in the equity markets necessarily. Equity markets have lagged that economic growth. And there are lots of different reasons for that, of course. But, you know, one might be that, you know, the incentives for US company bosses, CEOs, we could think of a few very rich ones, can't we? But the incentives are aligned potentially to the shareholder returns, you know, fully aligned to that. You will get more money if the share price goes up. So as an investor, you know that that company is going to be aligned with absolutely with you. Whereas other countries, perhaps again like China, the incentives are perhaps more broader, more social, more, you know, employing more people, less about making money, less about necessarily the share price going up. So you do have to think about that when you invest in different jurisdictions.
Interesting. Well, you touched there on the role that the Fed, the US Central Bank, of course, plays in supporting risk assets. And that brings us on to what's likely to be the biggest market event for this week, which is the US Central Bank's decision on whether to cut the interest rate. What are the key pieces of economic data that will inform that decision? And how many cuts are markets now expecting for the rest of the year?
Yeah, let's rewind a few weeks, and it's back to what I mentioned right at the beginning, right? That the Fed has sort of supported markets in the last the last few weeks, and that's really because we got some job data. I think it was a couple of months now ago. Job data that suggested that the strength in the U.S. job market wasn't quite what it seemed. There was some big revisions down, weren't there? And that then set the expectation that the Federal Reserve would be able to cut interest rates, despite inflation remaining sticky. And we've had just some recent data, inflation data out of the US, which is still elevated. It hasn't got back down to the target for the Federal Reserve, but they can now see a path based on the weakening job data. They can see a path where that inflation starts to come down in the future, allowing them to, in advance of that, trim interest rates, to cut interest rates. And it's this perfect path that I've been talking about, sort of between growth downside risk and inflation getting out of control, being able to cut interest rates going forward, that has been really cheered by investors. So the Federal Reserve looks as though it's going to be able to cut interest rates by 25 basis points, which is tonight, in effect. So again, as often in these chats that we have, they are on the eve of some major decision where we could potentially look really stupid in 24
hours. Just keeps it interesting, doesn't it, Ben?
It keeps it interesting, absolutely. It keeps me on the edge. But anyway, 25 basis points probably. But what will be more important, and what our listeners will have heard by the time they listen to this, is what Jerome Powell, the chair, will say in the press conference following. And what were the votes? We know there's been some changes in the Fed governors, which has been instigated by President Trump. Maybe future changes coming up. There could be some people vying for the federal chair position next May who might want to vote for a big cut. There could be a 50 basis point vote from a couple of the governors. A couple of the governors might vote for no change. This is really unusual. Normally, everyone votes for the same thing in the Federal Reserve, but there could be lots of different votes. I do believe that the vote will come down to just a 25 basis point cut. And then we'll have to start thinking, what about the final two meetings of the year? Will there be two more cuts? That's what's priced into markets. That's why equity markets are doing really well, because there is this promise of a chain of cuts. And that's really positive, as long as there's no recession. And that's why equity markets are doing so well.
Got it. So another path that's been interesting to watch this year has been that of the US dollar, mostly because it's gone in completely the opposite direction from what analysts, I think, were saying at the end of last year. The greenback fell pretty steeply in the first quarter of the year, but the descent has definitely eased off since then, suggesting maybe it's hit some sort of a floor. What do you think might be behind that?
Yeah, no, you're. Yeah, I was talking to macro strategist Chris Jeffrey earlier, a couple of weeks ago, actually, talking about what people were expecting at the start of this year. And he was saying that when we had a look at all the different investment bank outlooks for 2025, which are all written, you know, in November, December, the previous year, just about every single one was positive on the dollar. Look, President Trump had just been elected. He's going to do tariffs. The US exceptionalism is absolute and unwavering, and you want to be buying the dollar. It always goes up. That was basically everyone's view back then. And of course, since then, since the end of last year to talking today on the, what is it, the 17th of September, it's down 11% over that period, the DXY index. So it just shows you that people don't listen to strategists like me, basically. But it just shows you that sometimes when everyone is one way positioned, there's no one left to buy. I guess that's the lesson, isn't it? It's come down. And look, you did mention the S&P has been doing really well so far this year. The S&P 500 is up 12%. That doesn't include dividends, so it's up more on a total return basis. But just take the 12% index. Well, the problem is that the dollar, which is what it's valued in, is down 11%. The DXY down 11%. So it offsets pretty much one on one. So if you've been a US investor, great, you've got that 12%. But if you've been a foreign investor buying those dollars to invest in the S&P, your S&P's gone up, but your dollar's gone down by almost the same amount. So you've come out flat. It's not actually been a great year for dollar, the dollar part of the S&P 500. So, yeah, you've got to take that into account right now. And if you have a look at the dollar where it is today, and you try and assess versus history whether it's overvalued, undervalued, still looks on very long dated horizons that it's still a little bit overvalued. So there could be a little bit more falls to come, particularly if the Federal Reserve keeps cutting interest rates aggressively. People might be less inclined to invest in the US if there's less interest rate there to earn.
Okay, so it's not only the Fed in the US that's announcing this week. We've also got big announcements due from the Bank of England and the Bank of Japan. Shall we start with the UK? Last time the bank cut rates, which was back in August, the governor of the UK Central Bank, Andrew Bailey, said that the decision to cut had been finely balanced and that any future cuts would be gradual and careful. Has anything changed since then?
That was the big change, wasn't it? Where it was a cut, but it was a hawkish cut in effect, suggesting that there might not be any more cuts, or at least there would have to be some downside risk to growth to be cuts, and similar to what the European Central Bank said as well. And you know, last week they decided not to cut interest rates this time around, having signaled that they pretty much had reached where they wanted to be. We just today, actually, this just earlier, a couple of hours ago, got some UK inflation data. Core CPI, so core inflation in the UK, is running at 3.6%, headline 3.8% year on year. That's quite hot still, isn't it? So to be cutting interest rates, given that elevated inflation, you've got to have a view that, you know, growth is going to weaken, that inflation is going to come down, and again that you need to do some cuts in order to get ahead of that. That's what the Fed is doing, though, so it's not absolutely impossible that could be the case as well in the UK. But it feels as though the UK, the Bank of England, is going to be taking it a little bit easier, just going to decide to wait, probably won't make any change tomorrow on Thursday when they meet. And yeah, just decide to have a look and see, hope that inflation continues to fall, maybe as the economy slows a little bit.
So that's Thursday. Friday, I think, is Japan's turn. Yep. To announce. And I think they're also expected to keep rates on hold this time round. What will Japan's central bankers be thinking and talking about ahead of Friday?
There's a lot of central bankers chatting. I think there's three. We just talked about three. I think I read somewhere there's 16 this week across the globe. Wow. So there you go. So let's not go through them all. But the Japanese are going the other way in terms of their trend, aren't they? Everyone else is cutting. Japan, the Bank of Japan, would like to hike interest rates. They've still got interest rates very low. They're wanting to normalize them. In their definition, that means interest rates to go up. And they've been trying to stoke inflation. inflation for, well, basically for the last 30 years or so, trying to get it higher. And they're managing to do this quite successfully, but they're being quite tentative about hiking interest rates so they don't snuff out the increase in inflation. They probably will again be tentative on Friday, and they probably won't hike interest rates. But, you know, that would be the next move. If and when they do move, they probably would hike. There's also politics going on. I mean, there's politics everywhere, isn't there? The US and in Europe. In Japan, the politics, the prime minister resigned, and there's going to have to be a new prime minister. So when you have that degree of uncertainty, that sometimes leads to slower growth because, you know, people invest a little bit less. So at the margin, that would argue against a rate hike. But on the other side, maybe a new government, a new prime minister could hand out more fiscal giveaways, couldn't they? If they did that, then they probably would lead to the Bank of Japan hiking interest rates in order to offset that fiscal easing. So, yeah, I think for now they'll decide to not do anything, but the bias would be to hike interest rates, particularly if there's a bit of a fiscal giveaway coming up.
Okay, well, let's leave the central banks alone for a bit. Like you say, you probably won't go through all 16 of the announcements, but interest rates gives me a segue into another theme that I wanted to ask you about this week, Ben. Last week, I saw in the news that gold has passed another sort of milestone, this time $3,600 per troy ounce. And a lot of the commentary that I read around it seemed to focus on rising expectations of US interest rate cuts as an explanation. I think the idea here is that if the return from holding US dollars falls, then gold, which doesn't give you any yield at all, becomes relatively more attractive. Does that explain the rise in the price of gold, or is there something else going on?
I think so far gold in the last, I guess, 3 years or so has been going up whatever happens. It's just been the brilliant trade. I think what you've said is historically sensible, that gold as a zero yielding asset generally would be relatively valuable when all other yields are zero. You know, you might as well hold gold then. So usually when interest rates are cut, when interest rates fall, gold goes up. But gold was going up even as interest rates were being hiked in the sort of COVID times. So that didn't make any sense at all. And around then, remember, though, it was the Russia-Ukraine war, and it was the US seizing dollar assets or freezing dollar assets out of Russia, sanctioning dollar assets, that perhaps led to other central banks deciding to increase their holdings of gold because that couldn't be as easily sanctioned or seized. It's much more independent. There's gold being a currency that is a unique one across other fiat currencies, which could just be printed by central banks and can be used, could be weaponized in some instances. Gold cannot be printed, cannot be weaponized. You can just hoard it. So I think that's what's been driving partly the rising gold prices. The other thing that's been helping gold, of course, is the weakness in the dollar. So you mentioned that it's $3,600 per ounce, but the dollar has gone down by 10%, hasn't it, compared to lots of other currencies. So in other currency terms, it hasn't been as strong as that. Still pretty strong, but not quite as strong as that. But it feels as though in a world where lots of currencies are under pressure because of central banks' politicization, because of high fiscal deficits, you know, it sounds, doesn't it, that a lot of governments are looking to weaken their currency to try potentially to be a little bit more competitive in terms of their export sector. So, you know, if everyone's trying to devalue, what's the thing that you want to hide in? Well, gold is the only one that really springs to mind, isn't it? And I think, again, gold is benefiting from everyone else not doing particularly well in terms of currencies.
There are a few big factors there affecting the price of gold. I feel like I've used up quite a few of the numbers that were available for this week, but I've no doubt at all there are plenty more out there for your number of the week. What have you got for us this time, Ben?
I got 80, which is basis points. And that's, so I guess it's 0.8% in reality, isn't it? But 80 sounds better than 0.8%. 80 basis points is the yield that the French 10-year government bond trades over the German 10-year government bond, which is a bit of a weird thing to bring out. But what I'm saying here is that France, to borrow money from the French, as the French government costs you 0.8% more for every year for 10 years than Germany, which is quite a high amount. Remember, we just had this political issues in France. I referred to that before. The previous prime minister lost a confidence vote. There's a new prime minister who will now have to try and pass a budget. It's interesting because that's exactly the same yield premium over Germany that Italy is being charged. So France and Italy have sort of equalized. And it's also the same risk premium that the Euro investment grade corporate bond index trades over and above German debt. It's not totally like for like, because this is not a 10-year bond I'm talking about. The index is a blend of loads of different bonds. It's, on average, it's less than 10-year, but it just so happened to be 80, so I was going to use it as well. So the point is that France is now having to borrow at the same level as Italy, and also as an average investment grade European corporate, which I would say is a little bit unfair on France in terms of, you know, their ability to repay all this stuff, the unlikelihood of them defaulting, and also the potential political issues that you can get everywhere. I mean, Italy has not exactly been a bastion of political stability over the last few decades, has it? We've had a few flare-ups over that period of time. And would you really want to invest in an average investment-grade corporate in Europe? More than you would to the French government? No, actually, that's probably not an obvious answer. So maybe answers on a postcard on that one.
Well, thanks so much for your time today, Ben. And I look forward to catching up with you next month. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic or political issues or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against L&G in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information. Not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to L&G, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LGIM Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities, Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, Inc., a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.